From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sylvia Plath slept there. So did James Taylor, Robert Lowell, and Ray Charles. The place is McLean Mental Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. It's where the elite meet and have met since the 1800s to play a little tennis, go riding, and, oh yes, get psychotherapy. In this hour, portraits of madness, humility, and genius, America's premier mental health mecca, pre-Prozac. We begin with the latest on a titillating Saudi proposal for peace in the Middle East. A week ago, in a New York Times column by Thomas Friedman, Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah floated the idea of full normalization of Arab League relations with Israel in return for full Israeli withdrawal from occupied territories. Cameron Barr is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. I asked him if there was any chance of this happening.
Yes, some folks are taking it seriously. Several of the Arab states have spoken up in favor of it. I think, judging from their comments, it's fair to say that they're more enthusiastic about the Israeli withdrawal part of the deal than about normalizing ties. But it seems to be something that's coming at the right time. Most people in the Middle East, I would venture to say, believe that the Americans are not doing enough to try to ameliorate the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And Crown Prince Abdullah may be using this proposal to prod the Americans into action. And in fact, Secretary of State Powell today spoke approvingly about the plan and said that he indicated that the Americans would get to work on it. There's also reports here in Jerusalem that the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, has asked Washington to help him learn more about the proposal.
Cameron Barr, are you then suggesting that there is, in fact, a full proposal at the ready somewhere, that the Saudis have one that they're ready to put on the table? Is it that clear?
It isn't that clear. And to be honest, Tom, this is not a new idea.
Well, I guess the flurry of interest is that things have gotten so bad that people are suddenly looking for some way out.
Yes, and also that it comes from Crown Prince Abdullah. After all, he may be the single most powerful politician in the Arab world, when you think about it. And he's also the head of a country that's been a bastion of anti-Israeli feeling for, you know, let's say 50 years. It's important to remember the context here, which is that the Saudis may be looking for a way to look good in American eyes, in the sense that, you know, most Americans have come to know Saudi Arabia in the past few months as the home of 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers. And they also have been very critical of the United States for not doing more on the Israeli-Palestinian front, and this may make them look as if they're willing to do their part.
But Cameron Barr, you're suggesting that Israel would not welcome this conversation or the United States pushing this proposal?
For one thing, the proposal does not refer to the UN Security Council Resolution 242, which has always been the basis of Middle East peacemaking, partly because it includes some crucial wiggle room. And that's to say that it refers to Israeli withdrawal from territories occupied by force, referring to the 1967 war between Israel and the Arab states. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a big disagreement as to what that language means. The Palestinians have always thought that it means full withdrawal from all territories occupied in 1967, and of course the Israelis do not see it that way. And there's reason to believe that there was an intentional ambiguity put into the language of the resolution when it was drafted. So because the Saudi proposal does not speak of 242, it becomes unacceptable from the Israeli standpoint, because full withdrawal is not something that most Israelis, and especially not this prime minister, can work with.
Two questions in it. First, Cameron, when you say the Saudi proposal, what exactly are you referring to? Is this just something out of a New York Times column, or is there something more concrete floating around now?
According to the column, the Crown Prince had drafted a speech in which he offered the Israelis diplomatic ties, full relations with the Arab League states, which there are 22, in exchange for full withdrawal to those 1967 lines, which is to say that the Israelis would pull out completely from the West Bank and from the Gaza Strip and allow the Palestinians to have a state with its capital in Jerusalem. There's some talk that the Crown Prince may, in fact, give this speech at an Arab summit, which is to take place at the end of March. But I've also heard that idea has been shelved. And right now, probably, if this is going to come into reality, and it's a bit of a problem, frankly, for most of the governments to deal with it, because it comes as it does in a New York Times column and not as a sort of formal activity by a state. And if it is to gather any momentum, it will have to be because states, especially the United States, begin to work on it and to give it some heft.
If it appeared that, in fact, the Saudis could lead the Arab League to some kind of new position toward Israel, what might Israel be willing to do? What might be politically possible there? You said they wouldn't be willing to consider a complete pullout. What's possible from the Israeli perspective?
At this time, what's possible is a Palestinian state on 42% of the West Bank and on, I think, on all of the Gaza Strip, which is a much smaller piece of territory than the West Bank. Now, that shows you what the two positions are. The Saudis are talking about full withdrawal, and the Sharon government, at any rate, conceives of a state that is basically on about a half of the West Bank.
That sounds like a huge gap.
That is a huge gap.
It sounds, in that case, that all this conversation may, in fact, be moot.
Well, the Middle East conversation is never moot. I mean, just that the Saudis have come forward with this, that they may be using it as a prod to American action. They may also want to distract the Americans from focusing too much on Iraq. Who knows? It may suit enough people's interests at this time to have a new idea. I mean, there's nothing more precious around here in Middle East peacemaking than a new idea. And to have this, to work with it, that it comes from this heavyweight Arab state, can't be ignored. I must say the Israeli government has been very slow to react. The foreign minister, Shimon Peres, of course, immediately stood up and said it was a great idea. Today he called it fascinating, I understand. But the prime minister has been almost silent. There's this report that he's asked Washington to look into it and to arrange a meeting. But the media in the past couple of days has taken it up. Two of Israel's most prominent columnists wrote about it at length. And that may be a kind of frustration with what Sharon did last week, which was to give a speech to the nation that was intended as a kind of a pep rally. And the only really new idea he had in there was to create buffer zones to achieve what he called a security separation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I'll tell you, across the board, from the right and the left, that speech and that idea bombed.
Sounds like everyone's looking for a new idea, even if it's an old idea.
That's exactly right.
Cameron Barr is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. In some circles, a stay at a mental hospital once had a certain cachet, and a stay at posh McLean Hospital, the country club of American mental health institutions, was tops. It cranked up creative juices, inspiring Sylvia Plath to write The Bell Jar. John Nash of Russell Crowe's Beautiful Mind stayed there. So did generations of the nation's elite and disturbed. Tonight's guest, author and Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam, has written about the genteel agony and ecstasy of the McLean experience in his new book, Gracefully Insane, The Rise and Fall of America's Premier Mental Hospital. What's the role of the mental institution today? If you had a choice, which would you reach for in distress, Prozac or a nice long stay at McLean? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now in the studio is Alex Beam. Good evening and welcome, Alex Beam.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Alex Beam, you've got a hot book. It's all the buzz here. The New York Times Review of Books has given you a full page. Everybody's talking about it. Now, answer me this. Americans seem perfectly happy to ignore the mentally ill. Americans won't insure them. They walk by them on the streets when they're thrown out of institutions that are closed down. What's the fascination? And clearly your book has tapped into it. What's the fascination with the mental illness of the elite?
Well, I actually – first of all, there's a fascination with the elite. To start with, I think people are interested in celebrities, whom I've certainly exploited to a certain extent in this book. People are always interested in people who have more wealth than they do, people whom they perceive to be better off than they are, although, of course, those people really never are. But secondly, I quote Sylvia Plath at the age of 23, confided to her diary. She just read Cosmopolitan magazine in 1958, and she noticed there were two articles in Cosmo about mental health. And she says, you know, I've really got to cash in on this mental health thing. After all, I've been in a hospital. I think I'll write a whole book about it, which turned out to be The Bell Jar. I personally think that the fascination with insanity, if you will, which is prurient, like all fascinations, has something to do with a continuum. I think it's one of the few places other than the cemetery where many of us can literally imagine ourselves for better or for worse. I mean, on a simplistic level, perhaps we know someone who's had trouble staying in the so-called real or sane world. Mm-hmm. But on a more abstract level, at least I personally, can imagine a state where we're not having polite conversations in nice shirts with collars, but where we've actually let ourselves discombobulate.
We can all feel that edge of pathos somewhere and imagine, what if we put the pedal to the metal on that front? Where would that take me?
Yes. And I mean, so obviously it's always reassuring in a way to read about someone whose plight is more dire than yours.
You've taken that interest and you've centered it on an extraordinary mental hospital, a couple of centuries old almost at this point, with a very elite clientele. Why the elite clientele at McLean? How did that happen? How did that come to be?
Well, That's fairly simple to explain. There's both an economic and an intellectual elite. Again, that's the vein that I'm exploiting in this book. That one of the key facts is that Boston, for better or worse, was the economic and intellectual capital of America for about 150 years. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it competed with Philadelphia at first, and then in Boston. I'm sorry, then New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And secondly, Horace Mann, whose name is on public schools all over our great country, as a young legislator in 1836, proposed a two-tier system of caring for the mentally ill and created the Worcester State Asylum. And so essentially, from that moment on, at least in this state, which was at one time an extremely important state, thanks to Horace Mann, we had a private, fee-based, elite, exclusive mental hospital where the best families sent their people. And we had a state system, not only Worcester State, but obviously people listening to the show would recognize names like Boston State, Metropolitan State.
Some of them might. But what was Horace Mann's justification for a two-tier system of mental health, or did he need one in the early 19th century?
Well, there was a sense that paupers couldn't get into McLean, and that it wasn't literally true, just as it's actually in our day not literally true.
Mm-hmm.
Nathaniel Bowditch, who was hated the common man, actually set up a huge endowment at McLean for the $2.50 a day that it cost so-called paupers to come to his lovely hospital. But Mann perceived, again, like public education, public medicine, he felt there should be a public mental hospital. And that, a term that comes up a lot of people remember the movie The Snake Pit and these kind of hellish conditions in mental hospitals. Those are much more typically associated with a publicly owned and operated mental hospital than with a private hospital like McLean.
We're going to talk about that hospital in some detail and depth with author Alex Beam tonight. But Alex, before we get there, has the era of Prozac just brought an end to all this? The psychopharmacology explosion just pulled the curtain down on the importance of mental hospitals, or do they still have a major role?
Well, they don't have a major role at all. They're closing all over the nation. Hundreds of acres worth of mental hospitals have closed in our state alone. The fact is, a place like McLean now is really a dispensary for drugs. I mean, as you say, and this has been the case for over 20 years, the way a hospital like McLean stays afloat today is by being a very sophisticated outpatient unit. They treat a rather astounding number, some 10,000 outpatients. But you don't get to stay there for the minimum 40-day stay. In the movie A Beautiful Mind, for instance, John Nash is there for 80 days. That's the minimum observation period.
The minimum, 80 days.
Minimum in that movie when he went.
Well, that's a different era.
That's a very different era. Now you're there for 15 minutes. That's the length of the checkup you have with your doctor after he's given you your prescription.
And the prescription's written, and off you go. Good luck.
Good luck.
Wow. No more long stays at the mental hospital. We're talking this hour with Alex Beam. He's got a new book out. It's called Gracefully Insane, The Rise and Fall of America's Premier Mental Hospital. And it describes the glory days of America's fanciest, most luxurious mental institution. We'll come back and talk about the famous and the infamous, the elite, the artists who passed through McLean Hospital after a short break. Do you feel better or worse knowing that the glory days of the mental hospital are gone? And which would you reach for in distress? Prozac or psychotherapy? Xanax or a nice long stay at McLean, the country club of American mental institutions? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's premier mental hospital, a word that's already coming to sound a little bit like the Titanic. They're going down all over the country. But McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, was the country club of American mental health care in its day. Author Alex Beam has written a book, Gracefully Insane, The Rise and Fall of America's Premier Mental Hospital, where he chronicles the stays and the interaction with mental health care in that grand institution of lots of famous names. Alex Beam, you can join us if you like at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And here's a question. Are we better at dealing with mental health issues, mental illness today? Are we better at it or are we worse with the closing of so many hospitals? Alex Beam, describe McLean for most of us who've never seen it.
Tom, it's absolutely beautiful. It's still absolutely beautiful, and I encourage people, and I'm sure I'm not making myself any friends. I encourage people to go there, actually. It's a 250-acre campus. I was once on – I mean, it's like a –
It's in the suburbs of Boston, leafy suburbs.
Yeah, where much of the Harvard faculty lives. Indeed, the chairman of the board of McLean told me that there's more crazy people outside the walls in Belmont than inside. It's in Belmont, Massachusetts, which – and now when Frederick Law Olmsted, the great landscape designer, chose – the site.
Central Park and so many other famous northeastern public spaces.
With an interesting sub-career in designing mental hospitals. Mm-hmm. Designed the very beautiful Hartford Retreat, the Buffalo State Asylum. Ended his life at McLean Hospital, we feel obliged to note. But when he chose these 250 acres...
Let's just clarify that. Ended his life, meaning committed suicide there or just wound down his final years?
Well... I mean, it's not a rest home, you know. It's a mental hospital. So, catastrophically, sadly, Olmsted was a patient.
And died.
And died at McLean Hospital. And, mm-hmm. and to use an adverb I ordinarily would eschew, famously said, they didn't use my plan, confound them. There's a great debate about who designed McLean, and Olmsted had a plan that they, in fact, chose to ignore.
But it is... The photos show this very dramatic sort of federal-style brick and white trimmed, looks like a mansion, looks like where a robber baron would live.
Well, that particular photo is just one of about 20 or 30 mansions on the rolling hills of McLean. A lot of it is like 75 acres is open space. That particular mansion is known as the Harvard Club of McLean. That's up a Memorial Hall. It was built for 9 male residents. It's the photograph on the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. And each corner suite has its own bathroom, its own sitting room. The men who moved in there would move in there with their orderlies, their maids. And in addition, then McLean would provide them with nurses and with medical care.
Who paid for all this? It looks like you'd have to have a copper mine to build this place.
Many a Bostonian did have a copper mine, thank heavens. I mean, but that's nothing, Tom. That's nothing. The real story is you had these families that would literally build homes on the grounds. There was so much open space. The Schraft family, the Shaws, would have sort of Dottie Aunt Eleanor, and they would literally build what they called a cottage, which, of course, is about a 7-room, 2-story house. They'd move sort of Dottie Aunt Eleanor into the cottage. When she passed away, they would either bequeath the cottage to McLean or move in yet another relative or, you know, blah, blah, blah. These cottages are still there. And by the way, they're all going to be torn down for office parks, for elderly housing. So I urge people to do mental health.
You want the bus tour, the gray line, to be going
mental
through.
Mental asylum sightseeing, while you still can.
Alex, it begs the question, did Boston's elite produce more than its share of psychologically troubled luminaries, or is it just that we're stargazing here when we talk about McLean?
It's the latter. We're simply stargazing. And, of course, I mean, to be obvious, as you know, money equals access to psychotherapy. It may not be that these members of the so-called elite were more disturbed, but they're certainly much more able to reach for this kind of silver cure, if you will, the mm-hmm. gold-plated cure. In my book, there's rather modest descriptions of the kind of treatments that were in store for people who didn't have money. I mean, I interviewed somebody at Greystone in New Jersey who once saw 100 patients receiving electroshock at the same time.
Just completing a single circuit? Please no.
Not funny, and no, it's a horrifying idea to see 100 people
writhing
on a bed. You know, I mean, this kind of thing although you would have these kind of questionable therapies at McLean, the idea that that you would have sort of these mass executions or electrocutions, I guess I should say, would be out of the question.
We want to talk about who was there. We want to talk about what went on there. But tell us who first. Give us a rundown of some of the names we might know, and maybe some of the names and stories that we wouldn't.
Well, the most obvious ones from our generation, James Taylor's famous song, Knocking Around the Zoo. When James Taylor went out on concert tour in 1970, he talked about McLean to just about everybody. His sister Kate, his brother Livingston were also there. Ray Charles, it's not too widely known, frankly. I sort of assembled, in my introduction, I assembled a fictional McLean band, and I think Ray Charles gets pride of place.
At what age, in what period was Ray Charles there?
Yeah, he got busted for, this is a great story, for trying to smuggle heroin into Logan Airport at 1:30 a.m., on a private plane from Canada. And unfortunately, there was a customs guy awake, which was a real bummer for Ray.
Mm-hmm. And what year was this, Alex?
I believe it
roughly
was 1955.
Mm. Oh, so the young Ray Charles.
The young Ray Charles. I'm sure Ray would not do that kind of thing anymore. At least he'd be a lot more careful. Mm. Anyway, federal judge, Ray Charles was already the greatest blues singer of his time. And unbelievably, a federal judge said, if you can prove to me over a period of 5 years that you're drug-free, I'll essentially erase this charge. And so they cut a deal where Ray Charles would check into McLean twice a year, would play piano, in fact, at Upper Memorial Hall, which you were just pointing to, the hall that's on the cover of my book, play piano, groove, sleep with the nurses, have a great time, never tested positive for drugs, and then would check out. He's obviously an example of someone who was not mentally disturbed. The poets,
before you go on, and of course we want to hear all these stories, but I guess I'm obligated to ask, are you outing people in this book, Alex Beam, as having been at McLean, or all these issues of public record?
Well, first of all, we haven't outed anyone yet, so you're going to have to work a little harder for that. There are some people in the book not well-known, many of them not living. Ray Charles writes about his stay at McLean in his autobiography called Say Brother, where he complains about the heating and talks about scoring the nurses. So
so it's no secret in his case and the others that you write about, or
no,
of the living anyway?
Certainly none of these so-called luminaries. Robert Lowell wrote poems about being a McLean, as did Anne Sexton. Sylvia Plath's book, as you pointed out, is all about McLean. So
I guess in a lot of cases there was even a cachet around it. This wasn't a secret. This was something that came out in one's art, in one's literature or music. It was part of the rite of passage for artists.
Well, the people the consensus is that it was really Lowell in the late 50s who kind of made it chic. I even interviewed a woman who's no longer alive, unfortunately, the psychotherapist who quote-unquote cured Sylvia Plath, at least. And she hated these poets. She knew them all, and she thought they were all highly demonstrative and sort of indulging their so-called maladies. Now, I did not quote her as saying that in the book, because that's very unfair. Robert Lowell was very ill, for instance. Anne Sexton, it's an absurd red herring to put on the table when you're talking about people who ended their lives by their own hands.
Yes.
But there were poets, musicians, artists. I mean, you know, like in Bohemia, a stay in McLean, yeah, it had a certain arguable cachet.
Alex Beam, there's so much to talk about here tonight. Listeners are lining up to join us. Let's give some questions. What did we learn from 200 years of gold-plated mental health care at McLean Hospital? And I guess, did you ever sample the care at McLean or at a less vaunted hospital? And did it work for you? We're joined on the line right now from Edinburgh, Scotland, by Dr. David Stenhouse. He's a British writer and journalist. Good evening and welcome, David Stenhouse.
Hi there.
It's very good to have you. Thanks so much for joining us at this hour in Edinburgh.
I'm on the night shift tonight.
Oh, good. You have written about the cachet of mental illness, the relationship between literary figures and stays in mental wards and writing about it. Do you agree with Alex Beam that that's something that sort of came in, at least in the American elite context, through Robert Lowell writing in the 50s, or do you see an even longer history than that?
I think it's probably an idea that comes to us from the Romantics. You know, people used to say that Lord Byron was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And I think there's
much like Alex Beam. Sorry.
I think there's been that feeling that what madness does is it gives you access to a kind of view of the world that the people who are sane don't get access to, mm-hmm. and that somehow those of us who manage to hang on to our kind of fairly balanced view of the world make compromises which those who are mad don't have to make because they kind of cut through. The problem is, of course, that what you end up doing is you romanticize it. But it's very interesting that, you know, when you look at people like the sister of Henry James and William James, Alice James, the two of them said, she's a real artist. Now, neither of these guys were slouches, you know, but they said, you know, she is a real artist. She had significant problems. Mm-hmm. Robert Lowell, as Alex has said, was an extremely talented poet and a very ill man. But when you come to people like Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath, I mean, Sylvia Plath is a kind of neurotic, ambitious personality. And there was an element that she was seeking out a period in Maclean. And it does seem that, you know, in some ways, Maclean was the best postgraduate school teacher poetry that America had to offer.
Well, what about that, David Stenhouse? It's one thing to see romance in insanity when you're staying in this very posh facilities of Maclean Hospital, which is a kind of elite retreat. It's quite another thing if you're in the public mental ward.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think Alex's book, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I've been very much enjoying your conversation together, I think Alex's book is very fair on that and doesn't romanticize what can be a pretty hellish experience in every sense of the word. But as a culture, we're obsessed with the idea that there's something noble about madness. I mean, you mentioned A Beautiful Mind, but there's also Good Will Hunting, there's Girl Interrupted.
Yeah.
There's Prozac Nation. There's a whole list of books that one way or another plug into the drama, to the horror, to the authenticity. And that's what we're really looking for, I think, all of us in our world, the authenticity of being ill. Now, that's not to say that there's anything noble about suffering mental illness. And those of us who, you know, have had friends or relatives who've suffered from it know that there's absolutely nothing noble there. But as a culture, we are fascinated by it.
Well, let me put it to you, Alex Beam. Did Maclean, with its 250 acres and its beautiful landscaping, its beautiful buildings and facilities, did it somehow make all this romantic? Or was it it's in itself providing a kind of envelope of romance to mental illness? Or was it seriously, sternly dedicated in its heyday to simply solving these problems?
Well, it's not a toggle switch, Tom. It's not either one or the other. And I just like to briefly, Davis, thank you very much for your kind words. I you're really articulate on that point. And I am simultaneously capitalizing, really, as you said it best, on the purported romance of mental illness. But to get back to what you're saying, Tom, I mean, one of the most lovely people I interviewed for this book at the very beginning, I hope he's alive, Dr. Paul Howard, hated the title of my book. This man devoted his life at Maclean to curing, you can't cure really people, but to helping the mentally disturbed. And he hated this title. He said, there's nothing graceful about insanity. And the fact is, I mean, yes, there are some silly stories. There are rich ladies who checked into Maclean to do their Christmas cards, okay? There are these absurd shopping disorders. Robert Coles, the great psychologist, knew the crazy ladies of Codman who filled their rooms with boxes from Stearns and from Macy's. It is a beautiful place, as you suggest, but it's a gilded cage, and I don't. Some people were there to kind of perhaps cut up or goof off. Some people were lucky enough. I've come into contact with many. A lot of parents warehoused their kids here in the '60s, really for the wrong reasons. But romance, no. Davis in Edinburgh is couldn't be more accurate about that.
David Stenhouse, let me ask you this. With the arrival of the psychopharmacology boom, Prozac and all of its cousins, you've looked at literature, you've looked at mental illness in relation to literature. Are we losing something here when we don't have the kind of gilded cage and the song that comes out of it when we drug people with mental illness instead of treating them in the style that Maclean did? Are we losing something in terms of art?
Well, I think we maybe are, because I think what happens is the way that people write about that experience is much more to do with social history or with pure autobiography, and it's not to do with... I mean, what I think what Alex puts his finger on is when you look at someone like Robert Lowell, he wasn't sitting in the locked ward with a pen and pencil. He would, mm-hmm. he did take drafts. You know, he certainly noted down his impressions. Mm-hmm. But those poems that he published in 58 in Life Studies about his time at Maclean, they were poems that he wrote when he came home, when he returns to his young child and to his wife, and he had time to regret and to see what he had lost, and that's when he sat down and wrote it. So the idea that people in the midst of their madness or in the midst of their mental hospital were kind of thinking, hey, this is great material, it wasn't that way. Mm. But with the drugs now, with psychopharmacology, it is a different experience. Just one thing that occurred to me. When I was traveling in the States a few years ago, when I was finishing my doctorate, I went to Kenyon College in
Ohio.
The state of Ohio. Mm-hmm. And Robert Lowell, of course, studied there as a student. And somebody that I met there, one of the faculty, made the connection for me, which I was thinking when I was reading Alex's book, that somehow there was something comforting for someone like Robert Lowell to go to a place like Maclean, because, of course, in a curious way, Maclean is actually very like that kind of leafy campus, a time which Lowell was associated with kind of being the happiest time of his life. And I think one of the interesting things about Maclean is it's absolutely of its time. That
sure.
was the theory. You got people out the city, you let them exercise, you let them do their own thing, and that was the cure. And, of course, sadly, it wasn't often the cure.
David Stenhouse, thanks very much for calling in this evening. It's great to have had you on.
Thanks very much, Tom.
David Stenhouse is a British writer and journalist who has looked at the link between literature and mental illness. Let's grab a quick call before the break. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. I've really appreciated David Stenhouse's turn, because I think that I've been listening. My brother was at Maclean for a while. He actually committed suicide 10 months ago.
Sorry.
And I think that what Alex and David are trying to encourage, Tom, I would really second. The context for this discussion needs to take into consideration an enormous number of economic and social and cultural factors, mm-hmm. including the anti-psychiatry movement in the 60s, and especially in Massachusetts. That's important because in the mid to late 60s, Frederick Wiseman released a documentary called Titty Cut Follies,
sure.
which depicted the absolute mess that was Bridgewater State Mental Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that became
the antithesis of Maclean. The antithesis of Maclean.
Well, it was the antithesis of Maclean, but it also incorporated aspects of state mental hospitals that were very common in New England and across the country. But it led to a movement that ended up, I mean, depending on whose version of the history of psychiatry you buy, mm-hmm. that related to the deinstitutionalization movement in the 1980s.
Yeah. And the troubled on the streets.
Absolutely. So you got places like New York, which suddenly are housing tens of thousands of people who had been in mental institutions or in some kind of care facility, and suddenly they've been turned out onto the street. And
a long way from Maclean. Chris, I apologize, but we're coming on a break. We're going to have to take it right now. Thank you so much for calling in. We're talking with author Alex Beam about his new book, Gracefully Insane. Are the rich and artistic different in their psychodramas, or just more luxuriously cared for? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Alex Beam about his new book, Gracefully Insane, The Rise and Fall of America's Premier Mental Hospital. We're really looking back from the Prozac era on the golden age, in many ways, of mental health treatment and psychotherapy, not always effective, not always enlightened, but certainly where the rich went to find their cure, or at least to seek it. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are we better at dealing with mental illness today, or worse? And are the rich and artistic different in their psychodramas, or just more luxuriously cared for? Deb is on the line. Welcome, Deb. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on the air.
Sure.
You had asked earlier in the show about which is better, treatment centers, mental institutions, or Prozac.
Well, these days a lot of people aren't even given a choice. They're just given the pill. But I guess the rhetorical question is exactly that. You know, which path would you feel more comfortable on?
That is a very interesting question to me. I have been in a mental institution. It was actually more a treatment center.
Okay.
But they're very similar. And in the treatment center, it's just very intense psychotherapy.
Was it helpful?
It was very helpful. Totally changed my life. Totally turned my life around.
How old were you at the time, Deb?
I was 14.
And have you also gone the psychopharmacology path,
the
Prozac path?
However, I went the Prozac path because I was in the treatment center.
So it was combined.
Yeah, so and that's what I would say. I think the best way to go about combating mental illness is a double-pronged approach, a two-pronged approach,
mm-hmm.
with treatment and pharmacology.
Alex Beam, when you hear, you know, Deb has been through, was it McLean, Deb, or somewhere else?
Somewhere in Minneapolis.
Right. So it wasn't McLean, but she's faced the demons, and she's had both the time and the institution and the drugs to help. And, you know, she says it's both. If you look back on the history of McLean, do you think that many of the patients there before the Prozac era would have longed to have both? The relief
Well, it's very it's very hard to simplify and overgeneralize. Deb was very lucky because it sounded like that she had superb experience with psychotherapy, so-called talk therapy,
mm-hmm.
and she felt that some prescription drugs also, you know, alleviated her syndromes. That is the best of both worlds. And what you really can't get now is this what used to be called mental therapy. I kind of regret that David and I didn't bring that onto the table during mm-hmm. the last, because mm-hmm. that's what he's talking about, the romantic notion that comes from the French Revolution of all places, that if you take people out of their families, out of the city, to a nice place, basically they'll calm down. It's a way for dealing mm-hmm. with anxiety.
And now, that's all there is to it or something like
it's,
that.
It's rather simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's successful with some anxiety disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, we just don't do that because for money reasons. I mean, a bed at McLean's $1,000 a night. An insurance company won't pop for more than 4 or 5 nights. I really should take back my statement that they only pay for 15 minutes. That's the length of the psychiatric appointment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, psychiatry has been wrestling with this for 30 or 40 years. What's the proper mix of and only extremists, I think, would say, oh, psychotherapy is absolutely no use. And only extremists, of whom there are many, of course,
mm-hmm.
would say, you know, oh, the pills just mess up people's minds. You've really got to talk people through these things. Deb's talking about a hybrid situation, which again, logic and her own experience would dictate is very positive.
Deb, thank you very much for your call. Alex, take us through a bit of the evolution of treatments at McLean. This was purportedly the best treatment you could get in the United States. What did it look like over time?
Well, it was very, very good treatment. I mean, ironically, I was touting Boston as the intellectual and economic capital of America. It always was. Boston was always a little bit Bostonian, a little bit of a held back, a little bit conservative. So,
but good treatment in retrospect looks a bit hellacious.
Well,
electroshock, lobotomy.
Yes, but that's hardly the monopoly of McLean. But to go back to answer your question,
mm-hmm.
I mean. It really did start with this notion. The Quakers did it in Pennsylvania. Philip Pinel did it in France. This idea of taking people out, you know, just rusticating them, taking them out. Then the kind of super intrusive therapy and dunking them in water a lot. That was a big thing throughout.
Cold water or something?
Cold water, hot water, you name it. The lovely
mm-hmm.
Marat Sade, you know, Jean-Paul Marat is frying in a hot bath in that lovely play.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Jean-Paul Marat did fry in a hot bath at the asylum at Charenton. But the daring therapies, some of which you've mentioned, are really the property of the 20th century. And of course, looking back, they look quite. I mean, the ones you've mentioned are actually the more benign. Mm-hmm. Lobotomy is now called psycho something surgery. You still have lobotomies.
Mm-hmm.
You still have electroshock therapy called electroconvulsive therapy. But at the beginning of the century, you had much really almost insane things like having malarial mosquitoes bite schizophrenics in the hope that they would get that the malaria would chase out the schizophrenia.
Okay, let one demon chase another.
Yeah, I mean, then oddly, injecting the blood of epileptics into schizophrenics because there was an observation made, a correct observation, it turns out, that epilepsy and schizophrenia are somehow indicative. But cutting out a portion of people's lower intestine was deemed to be a cure for mental illness. So those things were much, much happier, you know, substituting a drug therapy than having someone mess around with your lower intestine.
But the whole panoply was there at McLean.
Yeah, there's actually a whole book been written about, for instance, use of lobotomy at McLean. And thank God McLean was a relatively slow adapter of this particular procedure and, you know, probably saved a lot of people's lives in the long run.
Kate is on the line. Welcome, Kate. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
I'm the ex-wife of 23 years, psychiatry, married to a psychiatrist.
All right.
The revolving door policy with schizophrenics in particular is of great concern to me because I'm friendly with people. I'm also an artist, by the way.
Kate, are you saying the revolving door policy that current policies have brought into play or something in the past?
Legislation, mostly, but including McLean. I've visited friends and family at McLean for the last 35 years off and on. And it has been pretty much R&R. There's been no personal tragedy involved.
Mm-hmm.
But McLean, of course, was the country club of all hospitals.
But the revolving door is a new thing. Is that what you're saying,
yes,
the quick in
is.
And out?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Mm-hmm.
And artistic people, myself included, are invariably trying to access the muse, which is a very passionate sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece is that Sylvia Plath tried to commit suicide just as she went into adolescence. And, of course, they kind of nursed her along, and she wrote these embryonic books. And then just before she died, her final suicide in England, she wrote some of the most exquisite poetry that is known in New England, you know, as a McLean alumna, if you will. So those are points I want to make. But there is a romanticization, indeed, of mental illness. But with regard to artistic people and people who have genuine talent, they are invariably, and I think probably, I can't think of anyone who isn't trying to access it. And as soon as someone accesses it and starts being very, very productive, there's an enormous cultural push to not allow that to happen because it's very odd.
Kate, we're coming up to the clock here, but we thank you for your call. Alex Beam, last thoughts. Is it? Of course, we're looking, and you said so yourself, at celebrities who came through a very elite institution. This is, of course, not glamorous in general, but did you see artists in your look at McLean coming up to their most productive periods and to the edge of madness simultaneously?
In some instances, yes. In some instances, what Kate says is true. James Taylor actually had several bursts of tremendous creativity at McLean, but I'm afraid he might have been one of the luckier ones. It was really, for many people, a place where they, as we said earlier about Robert Lowell, he was famous for annotating the Norton Anthology of Poetry. He could simply never get beyond annotating existing poems.
Alex Beam, you've clearly tapped a vein here. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Beam is author of Gracefully Insane, The Rise and Fall of America's Premier Mental Hospital. For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Friday, Academy Award-winning animator Chuck Jones died at his home in California. He was 89 years old. Jones created beloved characters such as Pepe Le Pew, Wile E. Coyote, and the Roadrunner. He also had a hand in developing Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. On Point movie maven Garen Daly shares this appreciation.
Back when I was growing up in rural Connecticut, TVs were all black and white, and there were only three major stations, NBC, CBS, and ABC. Things were much simpler. And every once in a while, I have the TV in the background, and I would hear this sound. And all of a sudden, I had to run to the TV set and see what it was. I didn't care if it was Looney Tunes or Merry Melodies. I had to watch this Warner Brothers cartoon. They were the best things going. They made the best cartoons. And, you know, they were completely different from any of those other things out there, like the Disney stuff, Flintstones or the Jetsons at that time. This was unique stuff, and I loved it.
Yes, very curious, very interesting.
I think I liked it more because the characters were so three-dimensional. They were specific. You know, Bugs Bunny was different. Daffy Duck was different. All these Warner Brothers cartoons were different, and these were all created or made better by Chuck Jones.
You're despicable. Yes, you're despicable. And despicable. And you're very definitely despicable. How a person can get so despicable in one lifetime is beyond me. It isn't as though I haven't met a lot of people. Goodness knows it isn't that. It isn't that. Goodness knows it isn't.
The humor of these cartoons was, it wasn't so wholesome. It was a sarcastic, more human humor. It was not the Disney stuff, which was basically made for kids. This was made for people who were thinking and maybe had a little bit of adulthood. And it was at that point that I realized that I loved the moving image. And Chuck Jones gave me my entryway into my love affair with movies and cartoons.
Be very quiet. Hunting rabbit wax. Kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit.
Kill the rabbit.
And then in the 60s, there was a Bugs Bunny comedy hour on primetime TV, and I got introduced to probably the most existential, exasperated, technologically challenged cartoon ever, Wile E. Coyote. I mean, can we ever forget how he would always go to the Acme Company and try and find some sort of technological gadget to try and help him get the Roadrunner for food? He was just looking for something to eat. And always the Roadrunner would beat him. And always, just before he was about to fall into this chasm, he would look at you, just like Buster Keaton did in the Silent Comics. Just before this tragedy was going to befall him, he was letting you in on his pain, and you connected with him. And of course, he fell right down into the bottom of the chasm. And of course, the big anvil fell on top of him. But he was never hurt. He was only humiliated. And that really was hilarious. And I would cry. I was laughing so hard that my sides would ache. It was amazing. And Chuck Jones is the man who created that. He created this existential hero with a minimalist amount of background where everything he's concentrating on are these two characters, almost like a Godot play. If that was the only thing he did, he would be in the pantheon of great animators and movie makers. But he did more. In 1966, he got together with one of his old buddies from World War II, Theodore Geisel. They had worked together on this private snafu, informational cartoons for the Army, sort of like infomercials of their day. The two of them combined together, and they made The Grinch That Stole Christmas.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch.
And when Jim Carrey came out with this film just last year with his live-action version of it, everyone kept saying, it's not as good as the original. Chuck Jones gave us the original.
I wouldn't touch you with a 39-and-a-half-foot pole.
Let's make no mistake about it. Without Chuck Jones, there would be no Saturday morning TV. Without Chuck Jones, there would have been no really good Flintstones or Jetsons or Scooby-Doo or their latter-day descendants, including The Simpsons, The Rugrats, and all the other animation that's going on. Chuck Jones was the father of modern-day animation.
Garen Daly owns the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and is On Point's movie maven. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR.